What is up, family culture hackers? Welcome to the movement to revolutionize your family culture, a movement to shift away from the norms and values established in a society saddled in all the negative, destructive patterns that we seem to perpetuate for some reason. These prevailing and pervasive beliefs are everywhere, and most of us know about it, but we don't really know what to do about it. If you are dying to make a change in your life somehow, but you are feeling stuck, it is not your fault. These dominant belief systems often live just beneath the surface of our consciousness, and you live out your day-to-day reacting to these beliefs. They have been passed on to you by society and our family. Family culture hacking is all about learning how to recognize these dysfunctional belief systems and stopping them in their tracks. You will begin to see them lurking everywhere in your thoughts and language, in media, music, and marketing, in education, in business and government, in politics, and in your daily habits. Every week, I will be interviewing authors and experts who have spotted dysfunctional patterns in the dominant culture. We'll unpack these beliefs and behaviors for you to analyze why we tend to repeat them, even though we know they are not okay. Then we'll discuss solutions and behaviors to replace the dysfunctional ones so you can start practicing them. The goal of being a family culture hacker is to learn how to envision something better for you and your family, your community, and the world, and start playing out a different role and writing a new script for yourself and your family. Welcome to the show. Hello, family culture hackers, and welcome to the family culture movement. I'm really excited to share with you. My next guest is Robert Newman, and Bobby Newman, and is welcoming to the show. And after going from a strong moral upbringing in Southern Oklahoma to a drug-related downfall that had him facing federal prison, he understood that those who are addicted feel and think, and that's what enables him to cut through the resistance and manipulative tactics of an addicted person and help them choose life and recovery. So welcome to the show, Robert. I'm really excited to talk about your experiences and your story and how we can successfully intervene with our families who may be facing an addiction. So welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. I'm glad to come on.
Yeah, I'm really excited to talk about this. But before we get into the conversation, I like to ask, what did you want to be when you were a kid? What did you think you would be when you grew up?
Well, you know, I went through the normal things. I wanted to be a football player. That was my goal. You know, I mean, it's nice. Like football. I was looking back at the time I was 6 years old, you know, and it was football.
Nice. So how do you think that dream shaped who you are, or how did that play out in your life at all?
Well, it was, you know, I loved playing football, loved playing sports. And, but you know, as I got older, I started to see that, you know, pro football was not necessarily going to be in the cards for me. But due to, you know, I was pretty good at it. I did play college ball, but you know, you're looking at a whole nother level of athlete.
And you did, though. That's great.
So I didn't really refocus my goal, I should
right.
say.
Okay.
Yeah.
But that's interesting. You were able to play college football, and that probably helped you to define some skills and some discipline as you grew in the sport and things like that. So that's interesting.
It did. Yeah, it did. You know, team play was always, you know, I did play in a, you know, a bigger school when I was younger. And then as I got older in high school, I played at a smaller school. And so that was team oriented, you know, so it was definitely a learning experience.
That's cool. That's interesting. I love learning what people were interested in when they were growing up and how it shaped them. And so that's really neat. So I'm excited to talk about this topic of addiction, addictive behavior, what we can do to help our families if they are steering towards addictive behavior ourselves. So what was your pivotal experience that you knew that you went through that has allowed you to become an expert on this and be able to talk about this subject?
Well, I went through my own challenges. Like, you know, like in the bio, it said, I started drinking, you know, I think the first time I drank was, you know, to intoxication, which I was 11 years old, but it was, you know, it was in it kids that, rodeo, just sneaking beers out of an ice chest, you know, I drink two beers. And so it wasn't like I was, you know, had a sub, I mean, it was an issue, but you know, when I was 15, 16, then it started picking up and we started doing it more and more regularly. And then it became, by the time I was out of high school, I started smoking marijuana. And then I went to college, played football, got introduced to amphetamines. Wow. And just kept going from there. So, you know, I just kept getting into trouble. And, you know, substance abuse never seemed to be the issue to me. I mean, it seemed to be something else. And, but then later on, after I got, when I was 35 years old and I was in a lot more trouble, and I couldn't stop using long enough to do what I needed to do to get out of trouble. Mm-hmm. That's when I realized, I'm like, wait a minute, this has got me by the, you know, it's got me and I can't get loose of it. So, but I didn't really realize that there was any, you know, I didn't have any faith in treatment. I didn't have faith in the rehabilitation process. So I was not willing to go through that because I just thought I didn't have any hope that there was anything out there that could help me.
Wow.
So that was my big objection to going to get help. It's like, what are they going to do for me?
You know? Right.
So.
Interesting. Did you mentioned when you said you, after you grad, you know, you finished college football, you said you didn't realign any goals for the future. Do you feel that your addiction played a role in that?
It's hard to say. I feel like that, you know, it did, but at the same time, my lack of setting a goal and setting, having like defining for myself and deciding for myself what I wanted to do. Right. And aligning myself with people. Now I had gotten some advice when I was in college, about, you know, you find the people that you most want to be around or be like, and you be around those people and you do what those people do and things like that. But I couldn't seem to find that group. And that, you know, and of course I should have expanded my circle of influence.
Hindsight is always 20/20, right?
yeah. But, you know, I feel like I always look back and I think if I could have picked something that I could have set, but like the goals and the things that I want to do now later in life, if I'd have had that inspiration back then, I probably wouldn't have let anything stand in my way. I would have been focused and goal oriented, you know, and, but instead I didn't. And so then the other temptations entered in.
Right.
And I was playing a different game. I was playing a different game of, you know, of not very smart things to be playing the game of, you know?
So. Right. Right.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like it. So it's kind of like this chicken or egg thing. It's like, did you get drawn to drugs because you didn't have a goal, or did you not have a goal because you had drugs in your life? Right. Like it's like, which one was the real issue here? Right.
I would think, I tend to believe that it's the lack of the goal that kept me from, you know, kept me from, you know, it caused me to become heavier addicted to substances. So
interesting. Interesting. Yeah. So that's so fascinating. And it's really interesting that you say that you didn't feel like the intervention resources in place were useful. Right. So that sounds frustrating like that, but I think sometimes that's kind of a common belief that we hear about people who go to these rehab facilities and come out and they go right back to it with full force, even getting maybe worse. So that's kind of a big issue. You find that that's a common belief, that people think that regular intervention or conventional intervention is it's superfluous, right? Like,
it I do believe that because I, you know, quite honestly, I mean, there's a lot of people out there. And I'm going to give you my own biases or whatever about it. I mean, you've got people in this industry, in the treatment industry, to be a counselor, they have to go through 4 years of school. A lot of times they have to get a master's degree. So you're looking at a lot of money that's spent on education, and they don't pay. It doesn't pay. That industry does not pay. It's almost like it's a cardinal sin to get compensated for your efforts in treatment. And I mean, there are people out there that have done things that are not okay as far as that goes, as far as money and things like that. But it's hard to get people in there that are going to be, you know, because you're going into big debt a lot of times to get a college education. You know, it's like for me to be a substance abuse counselor, have to be a master's, you know, have to have a bachelor's degree or a master's degree. you know, to be a licensed substance. Now I'm certified and I've passed the same test that a lot of people have, but I don't have the degree. You know, I've got some college, but I don't have the degree. So, you know, that's where, that's one thing. That's one barrier. And two is, you know, I, a lot of times people like me, I've went through it. I know,
yeah.
You know, I've dealt with, you know, and so my, my, not that you have to be an addict to have, to be a good counselor. That's not true.
Right. Right. Saying,
You know, I have the reality of like when I was on the other side, what I could still see through that. I could look back and see through that lens and go, okay, I used to think that.
Yeah. You know? That holds a lot of weight, I think, for people that are experiencing it. If they know that you have got, you've overcome it, you've conquered it. That I'm sure is really encouraging for them.
Yeah.
So that's interesting though, you bring up this idea of that all the education and not getting compensated well, and that's a huge frustration in a lot of degrees and career paths that, well, there's not a lot of money in that. So you're starting out your career in scarcity and in lack. And I don't know that you can really come from a place of real passion, right? If you're in a place of scarcity and lack. So that's interesting. Wow. That's so interesting. Okay. So, all right. So now I like to talk about, you know, this idea of addiction, okay, being so common in our dominant culture or in this culture that is so widely accepted, right? I think that addiction is something that we all just kind of accept in a way. So yeah. Tell us about this. Like, what is this one belief in our dominant culture that you want to address, you want to see change, that is just keeping us in dysfunction? What is going on there?
Well, there's a lot, particularly when it comes to intervention, you know, and a person will only get help when they want help.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, of course, you know, I've got, you know, that's the truth. I mean, but an addict is driven by pain and hopelessness, and people can become addicts for some sort of mental or physical trauma that they've experienced, mm-hmm. or they're trying to solve some sort of mental or physical problem. You know, It could be even as a kid trying to, you know, a kid that's bored, right? And somebody comes over with a joint. Oh yeah, let's do that. I don't have anything to do. Or it could be, you know, somebody had a surgery, you know, and they're in a lot of pain. And so they start taking the pain pills and they're not educated about the addictive qualities of the drug. So there's a lot of things that, so the tendency for people to say, you know, to turn towards chemicals to solve their problem is everything is solved by a drug. And the truth is that people should be more educated about what those chemicals can actually do.
Right. Know? So, but that's the plague is like, well, you have a problem. There's a chemical for that, right? And that's basically what you're saying is that's the plague. That's the plague on our culture is that ingrained belief. Wow. Wow.
Yeah. And you know, the thing is, it's all, and to be honest with you, I mean, there's marketing out there and people in your audience probably know about marketing and you're trying to get somebody to buy your product. And, you know, pharmaceutical companies are, you know, they're public companies, right? So they're stock shareholders and things that are, you know, profit driven. And so they do things a lot of times, but so that's where it comes down to our own responsibility and knowing what, and the same thing with the marijuana industry. So.
Yeah. Well, even that's where I live right now. We'll drive down the highway and see a dozen CBD billboards at least. You know, I'm in Michigan, so
I'm in Oklahoma. I'm from Oklahoma originally, and they just legalized it there. And it's the same. It's like the little town I grew up in is like a store on every corner.
Right. It's like, right. We need another cannabis store. What is going on? Like, I think, how are you even surviving? But it is a plague. It's something where people are feeling like they need that chemical to balance their lives. And that's really, that's scary. That's scary. So, but what you're saying is that they're not becoming educated enough about this problem.
Well, it's just like, I mean, I would venture to say that some of the people in this audience are probably going, oh, well, you know, marijuana could be useful and marijuana could, you know, it helps with seizures. And the truth is there are medicinal benefits to the marijuana,
mm-hmm.
right? But but they want you to believe that all of the marijuana plant, there's different parts of the plant that are actually beneficial. And there's different ways of ingesting it that would be beneficial where you get the medicinal benefits, but you're not getting high or the toxic effects of the THC. So you have to take a look at it and go, okay, what's the, because I mean, you've got somebody who, and there's also different instances, like, you know, so you've got somebody who's a terminal cancer patient who's in constant pain. I think the guy, you know, and maybe making him as comfortable as possible. And if marijuana does, yeah, sure. But don't say that it's going to have the same effect on a 15-year-old kid who sitting around smoking weed now that's like 35% pure THC. Back when I smoked it, it was about 3%. So, you know, and then, or you'd also have the oil or the salve that you could give to a kid, or maybe something that would, you know, to a child or somebody for seizures. So there's different uses. You just have to be smarter about it.
Interesting. Right? Interesting. So, and even like if somebody who goes through a surgery, you know, when I recently had a surgery, I guess it's been a year ago now. See, it feels recent to me now. But you know, they had offered me a painkiller and I had to sign something that acknowledged that it was an opioid, that it was that, right? Is that the word I'm looking for? You know, that it was a strong painkiller. And I had to sign something that acknowledged that they had told me what it was. And I didn't end up filling the prescription because I'm that afraid of addiction, you know, things like that. I just heard so many horror stories, but is that enough? Is that enough to be able to just sign something that says that you acknowledge that this is something that's going to be present and something you're taking?
I think that, I don't know. I'm actually glad that they were having people do that. Mm-hmm. But you know, I don't know. I mean, if I don't know that it's enough for me, I'm educated on the effects of drugs. You know, I'm sure there's probably information. I'm always looking for more information, but you know, they have to maybe understand there's always more education, but
right.
I can't say whether it was enough or not. I mean, I know that if you have a drug problem, you're going to sign a paper and roll on and not even pay attention to it.
Right.
So, you know, I'm glad to hear that they did that, but you know, I don't know if they still have it, but I lived in Hawaii for a while and they had the hospitals out there would have you sign this comfort thing where it had to do with that pain was now a symptom, right? Mm-hmm. Or pain, I forget how they say that, but in other words, you have to treat the pain. Now, obviously the pain is, you want the person to be as comfortable, but they would ask you, what's your pain level today? So it was an idea. It was basically a way that they could put more opiates, give you more opiates. And they, you know, and the hospitals wanted to have good ratings. So they would, if you were, you know, got a bad, if you said, oh, I'm at 8 out of 10, then they're going to say, oh, well, we don't want you to
be in pain. We don't. Yeah.
Yeah. So here we're going to give you all this stuff. So, but, so yeah, people just need to be, educate themselves.
Yeah. You know? Well, that's an interesting. Okay. Yeah. Well, that's an interesting point that you bring up, that it's the system, it's ingrained in the system, even that you talked about. Okay. You talked about big pharma. I don't know if that's what you would call it. Pharmaceuticals where they're driven by profits, and hospitals that are driven by ratings and probably, you know, their donors or whatever, things like that. Right. And wanting to appear successful, and that those chemicals are surface level of grading systems or of how we look in terms of success. Right. Yeah. So that's people need to wake up to that, right? Like, hey guys, there's a system. And that's a big part of what this podcast is all about, is educating people that look, there is a system. And I'm not big on like conspiracy theories or anything like that, but there are systems in place that are keeping us oppressed. Right? Like there are things that are in place that are keeping us blind and ignorant because it benefits those people who perpetuate those systems. Wouldn't you say that?
Yeah, yes, it does. And it's money driven. And I'm not saying, you know, especially with the political climate and everything else going on the last year and a half or 2 years, 3 years, whatever, you know, I don't really pay attention to a lot of the noise and stuff that's going on. I mean, I do pay attention enough. I kind of check, I'll check in, but I'm too focused on what I want to do. And I would venture to say that a lot of your public and you're in this pod listening to this podcast are also they're focused on what they, you know, and it's like we were talking about before we came on, is the similarities between, you know, an entrepreneur, somebody who's working the extra hours and working the weekends, missing the ball games, or doing, making the sacrifices to try to, you know, do what they're trying to do, you know. A lot of that aligns with what we're, when it comes to handling an addict, mm-hmm. you have to have the same type of mentality, and you have to expect that person to solve that problem.
Right.
Okay. There's a problem and we're going to solve it, and we're going to learn about how to solve it the best way. And if it doesn't work the first time, we're going to keep trying until it works.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And a lot of times people, when it comes to addiction, they tend to, those things that are ingrained that they know kind of go right out the window. And it's really hard, because I have a 29-year-old son who about 15 years ago went through this, and, you know, I do this for a living. This is what I do. I've helped thousands of families, but it came to my own son, everything that I knew went right out the window. So,
but we need to be able to, to educate ourselves, and also surround ourselves with the kind of people that can encourage us to grow and to find those solutions. Yeah. Like a lot of these things going on, we need to understand what they're going on, but how it impacts us individually, right, is really the biggest part of it. Like, how is it affecting us individually and our families, and what we can do about it? That's really powerful.
Well, that's so, right. Right.
So tell us a little bit more about your philosophies about intervention. What is the appropriate way to address somebody, a family member that has an addiction, or a close friend, things like that? What is the process?
Well, that is, you obviously want to try to find a solution for the person. You know, if they come to you and somebody confides in you, number one, I would make it as safe as possible for that person to communicate with you. Mm-hmm. Like, in other words, if I come to you and I say, I've got a problem and I really need help with it. Thanks for telling me. You know, what would you like to do about it? You know, make them feel like they want to talk to you, especially if it's your daughter or your, some family member. Make them feel safe. And then, but expect them at the same time to say, okay, well, let's figure out what we're going to do about that.
Good. Right. Yeah. You want to find the solution. Because as you're talking, what comes to my mind is that a lot of times, sometimes parents or a loved one could become an enabler into an addict. Like, what happens in that situation? Like, what can we do when we either are becoming an enabler or the addict is taking advantage of us if we don't recognize the behavior or things like that? Like, you know what I mean? I feel like I hear stories about people that they can't trust the addict anymore, or the other extreme where the parents become an enabler.
Well, it's very common that I'm going to help this person out. He said, well, I can't pay my bills, or I wrecked my car and I got put in jail and I need to be, dad, can you come bail me out? Things like that. And, you know, I always got bailed out. My family would always come bail me out. I mean, I had something going on all the time. And there's something I told my son. I said, you know, when you get older, I'll help you out, but I'm not paying for an attorney. I'm not paying for fines. I'm not paying a bail bondsman. Don't call me at 2 a.m. to come get you out of jail. If you wreck your car, too bad. You know, if you get a ticket, you lose your license, any of that stuff, you know, you just have to figure it out.
I'm
not going to fix it for you. You know, but, you know, he's moving, got a new job, moving to Miami, doing really well. You know, hey, dad, I need a little money to get down there on, you know, or, you know, I've got a job, you know, he's got something going on to where he's trying. I'll help him out, you know, because he's doing well. I'm putting money, you know, investing in him, you know, but I'm not going to go in and clean up his mess. I told him, don't bother calling me. So that's where you don't pay their bills. You don't pay their phone bills. You don't pay it. You know, if you're I don't give him any money for drugs, you know. Well, if you're giving him money for anything, he's using the money he's got to buy drugs with. It's like, you know, you have to say, you know, you want to get some help, I'll help you. But, you know, you're not going to move in with me. I mean, I'll give you an example of a guy who, this guy, kid was up in South Dakota, and he had got arrested and his mother was trying to talk to him about drugs, and he pulled a knife on her. Now he was like several feet away, and it wasn't like he never was in any danger, but it was enough for her to like okay, I can enforce this and I can get this kid off the street. So she did. And they actually, the law enforcement there at the time was very rehab oriented. Well, he got put in jail and had called his landlord, who was, he was buddies with, to get him out of jail, $3,000. He had to put $3,000 up. Well, he had no idea why the kid was in jail. And so then he comes to the mom who I was working with to get the kid in rehab, so hitting her up about his money. And I said, and she says, what are you talking about? You know, well, I got him out of jail. I got your son out of jail. I said, do you know why he was in jail? No. He was in jail for pulling a knife on me. Right. So I'm not, I wanted him to
I'm
stay.
I'm not going
to
pay you for that. Yeah. Oh my goodness.
So people, you should find out what the problem is and what caused it before you start investing or flowing anything that way. Yeah. This is like, it's, you know, and look and say, okay, where's my money going? You know, is it going to be going towards a solution or is it trying to, you know, clean up the problem, you know, or continuing the problem.
Right. Right.
So
we mentioned earlier that some of these conventional rehabilitation services aren't always very effective, or there's a stigma around them not being effective.
Yeah.
What is the answer? Like, how can we help rehabilitate?
The three major barriers to overcoming addiction are, and anybody will agree with this, this is surveyed for a gazillion years across all treatment modalities or, you know, methods. There's the three biggest barriers are cravings for drugs. It's drugs or alcohol cravings for the substance, depression, and guilt.
Mm.
If you don't handle those three things, the likelihood this person is going to stay sober is not very high.
Right.
Just not. So a lot of people want to handle the cravings. It can take several weeks for that to subside. Also, depression in today's, you know, in culture, they want to medicate everything,
right?
Well, chemicals and toxins alter the neurochemistry of the brain. They inhibit the ability of the body to function normally. So you produce the chemicals in your brain, the dopamine, serotonin, things like that, that cause you to feel good,
right?
So people want to give you more antidepressants, which, by the way, also have side effects. And it's so nutrition, good new sleep, good, you know, getting regular sleep, 8 hours sleep, good nutrition. An addict usually has a very poor diet. They usually eat a lot of sugar, you know, so you have to learn all the basic things that to overcome the cravings and the depression.
Wow.
And then the other thing is with guilt, you know, a lot of times, you know, particularly with a 12-step program, you go out and you make amends, you take a moral inventory, you make amends. Those are great. But a lot of times people don't understand how to forgive themselves for some of the things they've done.
Right.
And that's another thing that where, you know, it's really hard to where, you know, it doesn't mean that you don't take accountability and you're not accountable for those things, because you are. You're taking responsibility. But at the same time, you've got to at some point move on.
Right.
And focus on, you know, okay, that was yesterday. I got to worry. Yep. I'm thinking about tomorrow.
Wow. You know,
and I'm getting myself ready today for tomorrow. So, you know, those are the three things. And unfortunately, you know, a person, they tend to think a 30-day program is going to actually, I'll go in for 30 days or I'll go to a counselor. And they always want to undercut what it takes to overcome those three barriers.
Mm-hmm.
And then they get the idea, well, treatment doesn't work. Well, the truth is even a 30-day program, unfortunately, has about a 90% failure rate.
Mm.
Doesn't matter what you do, a 30-day program. So, you know, people say, well, how long am I going to be in there? I'm like, and a lot of times with an intervention, I'll say, well, your kids just asked for their dad back. So I would be in there long enough, if it were me and it were my kids, I'd be in there long enough to where I could give my kids their dad back.
Right.
I don't know if that's going to be 3 months, 2 months, 3 months, 6 months. I don't know, but that's what I would be focused on. Not how long am I going to be in there? Because the likelihood you're going to go in there and waste even 30 days is about 90% of the time you're wasting that 30 days.
Yeah.
I had one guy once that called me and he said, I've been to, you know, well, I want to get you into a 90-day program or a program that's, you know, 90 days or longer. I don't have time to do that. I'm like, what do you mean you don't have time to do that? He said, I only have time for 30 days. I said, you've done 8 30-day programs.
Right.
So, you know, obviously, if you're looking for to do that again, I don't know that, you know, it's a disservice. You know, I'm going to have to give you another number to call.
Wow. That's so interesting. Yeah, that's great to have the healing at the heart of what you want to accomplish, not just the amount of time. That's that's fascinating. I love that. I love that. So the craving, depression, and guilt. Wow, those that is really powerful. You know, I think that those are that totally rings true. Like of every kind of addiction, if it's food, if it's intimacy, if it's, you know, if it's drugs, chemicals, all those things come back to being chemicals in our brains. Right. And so and all of those stem from, whether it's a craving or they stem from the depression where you just want to reach for something to make that feeling go away or the guilt that keeps it perpetuated. That's wow. Thank you. Thank you, Robert. That is really powerful. I really appreciate those insights and being able to acknowledge those things, being able to, you know, I think that being able to approach our loved ones with that perspective of love and support, being able to say, well, let's set up a system where we recognize when you have a craving. Right. Or let's set up a system where you recognize when you're feeling depressed, or let's set up a system where you recognize you're feeling guilty and then what to do about it. Right. Is that kind of the approach that you would take
started? Yeah. 100%. And it aligns with, you know, for me, my mindset, like we talked about before we came on is my son, worked for a big time. He put a guy down in Miami that put on these entrepreneurial conferences every year. Mm-hmm. And he got me to go to this conference. And I was like, yeah, I want to go hang out with my son. So it was in Vegas. So I'm like, what the heck? That's nice. Really fun. But I went and I listened to all the guys that were in the conference and they had some common traits. I mean, they had common things that they all did. I mean, they came from different backgrounds, did different things, but they had, you know, they worked hard, you know, they talked about, you know, one girl even got up there and talked about depression and anxiety. She said, you know what? You know, if you're depressed, you're worried about something that happened yesterday. Mm-hmm. Right. And if you have anxiety, and there could be physical reasons too. Why? I mean, you know, if you're anxious about something, anxiety is a fear of the unknown.
Right.
I don't know what's over the next hill. Right. Well, let's get over the next hill and figure it out. Let's go look, you know, and me, I was an addict, you know, was an addict and, you know, I was in a lot of trouble, but in my mindset now is that I'm even sitting around watching TV. Now I might watch a movie with my family or something, or I might sit down at the end of the night, late at night, and I want to watch a show before I go to bed, but I usually don't make it. I have to watch the same episode like five times before I get all the way through it because I fall asleep. But I look and you know, I can't just sit down in the middle of the day and just sit down and just be idle because is this going to get me further closer to my goal?
Right.
The things that I have to do today. No, it's not. So I don't have time to do this. I've got every day. It's like the basic things that a person does every day. If you do those things, it builds towards that longer term goal. Yeah. And so a lot of we talked about a lot of the people, if they would apply the same thing to addiction that they do in their daily lives, that are people that are successful in business and things that are really working, you know, their tails off, then they could, you know, I always talk about, you know, I'm going to outrun my depression.
Nice. Yeah.
I'm leaving it back there because I'm going here.
Yeah.
I love that. If I stop long enough, I'm going to, anything can come creeping in.
Yeah. No, that's so true. You know, Robert, that's one of the things I talk about with family culture is a lot of it stems from what are our coping mechanisms? What are the default coping strategies that we have in our lives that end up defining our character and our culture? Yeah. And if you get stuck in a coping mechanism that is addictive or degenerative or things that deteriorate your character, your trust in yourself or things like that, then you're going to slide. But when you adapt your coping mechanisms to be constructive, then you're going to, like you said, you're going to outrun your depression. Well, you can outrun your boredom. You can outrun your cravings. You can outrun your guilt, right? Like if you create habits and coping mechanisms that are constructive and productive, then that's going to be a really big key. So
I had a friend of mine that, cause she always is a great girl, and she used to have five or six things going on all at one time, but she always had a problem. She was trying to solve her family or this or that. She got on Facebook one day and she says, oh, some little something about some problem that she had. I mean, it was kind of like, I'm like, and I told her, I said, you should get a tiger and put it in your front yard. Right. She said, what's that going to do? And I said, well, you won't be worried about that little piddly problem anymore. You'll be figure out how you can get in and out of your house.
Let's put it in a perspective here. Yeah.
Oh, that's funny. Have enough problems. Maybe you figure out a good, cool problem that you can have. Like, how am I going to buy that Mercedes Benz over there? Okay. Let me solve that problem instead of worrying about this other one. Over
yeah.
Here.
Oh, that's so funny. Yep. Keep things in perspective. That's awesome. Yeah. Oh, Robert, it's been delightful talking with you. I really appreciate you coming on the show, sharing your insights and your experience. And I want to honor you for how you've healed your life and being able to show up now to be an example of somebody who has been able to recover from this, your addiction. So I appreciate that a lot. And sharing your insights, give us encouragement. I really, really appreciate that. So tell us where we can find you and learn more about you.
My number, you can call me at 866-989-4499. That's my hotline that I know by heart. I have a website. It's newmaninterventions.com, N-E-W-M-A-N interventions.com. And then we also have another thing that we're doing. It's called Angel Life and Sober Coaching, and where we help people that are either have completed a program or maybe they're not quite in need. I mean, they're on the verge, you know, of and who might need some just life coaching. Mm-hmm. And we actually started that. And that's angellifecoaches.org. So we've got a couple of different ways to, and we just want to, people can reach out and ask questions. We're here to help somebody. You know, we have all kinds of resources for people that are very, you know, free or inexpensive. So
awesome. You know, awesome.
So that's the ways.
Awesome. So also I have my, have a family leadership toolbox that I have available for all of my listeners. And Robert has a gift he's contributing to the toolbox called the 25 Tips for Successful Intervention. Will you tell us a little bit about that, Robert?
That actually is thank you. It basically is that what exactly I go over with the family as I sit down with them before we do an intervention. And there's a lot of different things that you need to consider, but you know, these 25 tips are just to over, you know, you know, people go, I'm going to go do an intervention on my uncle. Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you have a treatment program lined up? Well, no, we don't. Okay. Well, let's do that first.
Yeah.
You know, let's lay this. Basically, this is designed to lay it all out to where when we do go talk to our uncle, all we got to do is get him to say yes. Every problem that he's going to come up with that's why he can't go, we're going to have already solved for him. And all we got to do is say, you know what? Listen, we've already know when the plane flight's leaving, or we're going to make it, everything's laid out for you. Here's the itinerary. Nice. Let's go. Nice. And so that's the way that's what the 25 tips is for.
Awesome. Well, I'm excited to share that with my audience and they can get that inside of the toolbox. So thank you so much for that gift. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Awesome. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Robert. It was really delightful to talk with you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Family Culture Hacker, for tuning in to the Family Culture Movement. I have so much fun creating these shows and having these discussions because I know that it is what is going to help us shift our vision towards a family culture of intentionality, trust, sufficiency, and growth. Thank you for being part of this movement. Help more people be part of this movement and find this podcast by liking and sharing and rating and reviewing the podcast and going on social media and finding me there. You can connect with me at Family Culture Podcast on Facebook and Instagram and at Jody Chafee everywhere on all social media platforms. Thank you again for being here. And remember that if you want to change the world, go home and love your families.